protect me and hide me, when there was a chance she couldn't take care of herself. It was too much to think about now, too much to consider and agonize over in a logical way. My brain was still thrumming from the effects of the white noise, but my weak heart made the choice easy for me. "All right," I said. "I'll stay. And hope that none of us regret it." The deep wrinkle that had appeared between Liam's brows eased, but didn't disappear. I knew he was studying me, his light eyes flicking over my face, trying to figure out, maybe, why I had hesitated so long to agree. Whatever conclusion he came to made him sit back with a sigh and adjust the mirrors in silence. Liam had the kind of face that you could read and instantly know what he was thinking. It made it easy to trust that whatever he was saying was true. But there was a practiced quality to his expression now, an intense concentration to keep his face blank. It looked unnatural on someone who seemed to always have a grin tucked in the corner of his mouth. I leaned back, trying to ignore the throbbing in my head and the pitiful dying animal noises coming from Chubbs once he remembered how much pain he was in. Liam silently passed him a half-empty water bottle from under the driver's seat. I glanced back at Zoo out of the corner of my eye, but the twilight had lulled her to sleep. A thin sheen of sweat coated her forehead and the skin above her lips. The car rumbled back to life. Liam exhaled as he cut a diagonal path through the parking lot. He didn't seem to know which direction to turn when we finally found the road. "Where are we going?" I asked. He was silent for a moment, scratching his chin. "We're still headed to Virginia, if I can find it. I think we crossed the state line a while back, but I don't know where we landed. Not too familiar with this area, to be honest." "Use the damn map," Chubbs groused behind him. "I can figure it out without it," Liam insisted. He kept swiveling his head back and forth, like he expected someone to appear and guide him in the right direction with road flares and fanfare. 5 minutes later, the map was spread out over the steering wheel, and Chubbs was gloating in the back seat. I leaned over the armrest, trying to make sense of the pastel colors and crisscrossing lines on the flimsy, ripped paper. Liam pointed out the boundaries of West Virginia, Virginia, Maryland, and North Carolina. "I think we're about here." He pointed to a tiny dot that was surrounded by a rainbow of crisscrossed lines. "I don't suppose Black Betty has GPS," I asked. Liam blew out a sigh, patting the steering wheel. He had decided we were going right. "Black Betty may drive the straight and true path, but souped up, she is not."
"I told you we should have taken that Ford SUV," Chubbs said.
"That piece of..." Liam caught himself. "That box on wheels was a death trap, not to mention its transmission was shot to hell."
"So, naturally, the next choice was a minivan?"
"Yep. She called to me from the parking lot of abandoned cars. The sun was shining through her windows like a beacon of hope." Chubbs groaned.
"Why are you so weird?"
"Because my weird has to be able to cancel out your weird, Lady Crossstitch."
"At least what I do is considered an art form," Chubbs said.
"Yes, in ye old medieval Europe, you would have been quite the catch." "Anyway," I cut in, now in full possession of the map, "we have to be close to Winchester." I pointed to a dot on the western end of Virginia.
"What makes you say that?"
Liam began.
"Are you from this area?"
"Because if I'm not, I just remember driving past Kaiser and Romney while the two of you were out. And with all the Civil War trail signs, we should be near one of the battlefields."
"Those are some good detective skills, Nancy Drew. But unfortunately, those signs pretty much mean nothing in this part of the country," Liam said.
"You can barely go 50 feet without hitting a historical marker for the place this army crossed, or that guy died, or where James Madison lived."
"That's in Orange," I interrupted. "We're nowhere near that."
The soft blue light of evening gathered around his blonde hair, stripping it of color. He studied me for a minute, scratching his chin again.
"So you are from Virginia, then?"
"I'm not," he held up a hand.
Please. No one outside of this state gives a crap about where James Madison's house is. I sat back. Walked right into that one. It was my mom's fault. As a high school history teacher, it had been her personal mission to cart Dad and me around to every major historical site in the area. So while my friends got to have pool parties and sleepovers, I got to walk around one battlefield after another, posing for pictures with cannons and colonial reenactors. Fun times. Made even more fun by the thousands of bug bites and peeling sunburns I always showed up with on the first day of school. I still had scars from Antietam. Liam smiled at the dark road, keeping the minivan's headlights off. I thought it was fairly brave, or stupid, considering the Commonwealth of Virginia had never considered it a priority to install lights on its highways and roads.
I think we should stop for the night, Chubb said. Are you going to find a park?
Relax, buddy, I got this, Liam said.
You keep saying that, Chubbs muttered, sitting back. And then it's, oh, sorry, team, let's huddle together for warmth, while the bears try to break in and eat our food.
Yeah, sorry about that, Liam said. But hey, what's life without a little adversity?
That had to have been the fakest attempt at optimism since my fourth grade teacher tried reasoning that we were better off without the dead kids in our class because it'd mean more turns on the playground swings for the rest of us.
I lost track of their conversation after that. It wasn't that I had no interest in hearing all about the bizarre traditions and habits they'd managed to form in the 2 weeks since escaping their camp. I was exhausted with trying to figure out why, exactly, those two were able to cling to the thin thread that bound their friendship together. Eventually, Liam found Highway 81, and Chubbs found a shallow, restless sleep. The endless stream of old trees, only a few fully dressed for spring, passed by my window. We were going too fast, and we were too far into twilight for me to make out the patchwork of leaves that had grown in. Wherever we were, there were still traces of the dead leaves from the fall before staining the highway cement, almost as though we were the first car to drive the road in quite some time. I leaned my forehead against the cool glass, reaching over to point the AC vent directly at my face. My headache was still there, pinching the space behind my eyes. The freezing air would help me keep awake and, if nothing else, alert enough to catch my mind blindly groping for Liam's.
You okay?
He was trying to watch both the road and me. In the dark, I couldn't do much else besides make out the curve of his nose and lips. A part of me was glad I couldn't see the bruises and cuts there. It had only been a few days, a blink in my collective 16 years of life. But I didn't need to see his face to know soft concern would be there. Liam was a great many things, but mysterious and unpredictable weren't included in that deck of cards.
Are you okay? I countered.
The car was quiet enough for me to hear his fingers drumming on the steering wheel.
Just need to sleep it off, I think.
Then, after a moment, he added,
Did they really use that on you at Thurmond?
A lot?
Not a lot, but enough.
I couldn't tell him that, though, without fanning the flames of his pity.
Do you think the PSF's figured out where you're going? I asked instead.
Maybe. We could have just been at the wrong place at the wrong time.
Chubbs woke behind us with a loud yawn.
Not likely, he said sleepily.
Even if they weren't intentionally tracking us, I'm sure they are now. They were probably forced to memorize your ugly mug and psi number. We already know you're a tasty treat for the skip tracers.
Thank you, Mr. Sunshine and Smiles, Liam gritted out. For what it's worth, the guy seemed surprised that it was actually you, I said. But who is this person you keep talking about? The woman?
Lady Jane, Liam said, as if that explained everything.
Excuse me?
It's what we call one of the more persistent skip tracers, he continued. First, it's what you call her, Chubb said. And second, persistent? Try, she's been on us like a shadow ever since we got out of Caledonia. She shows up everywhere, at any time.
Like she can guess what we're going to do before we do it.
The lady is good at what she does, Liam confirmed.
Can you please not compliment the person trying to drag our asses back to camp?
Why do you call her Lady Jane? I asked. Liam shrugged. She's a rare British lass in a crop of bloodthirsty Americans. How did that happen? I asked. I thought they closed all the borders. Liam opened his mouth to answer, but Chubbs got there first.
I don't know, Green. Why don't you hit her up for a chat and tea next time she comes around to capture us?
I rolled my eyes. Maybe I will if you tell me what she looks like.
Dark hair up in a bun, glasses, Liam began.
Long, sort of hooked nose, I finished.
You've seen her?
In Marlington. She was the one driving the red truck, but...
Kate and Rob had taken care of that. She had been left behind.
Well, she wasn't there this time, I finished. Maybe we lost her for real.
Fat chance, Chubbs grumbled. The woman is a Terminator.
We passed one run-down motel after another, some occupied more than others. I sat up in my seat when Liam turned into an old Comfort Inn's parking lot, only to immediately back out of it with a low whistle. There were no cars in the parking lot, but a dozen or more men and women were hanging around outside of their rooms, smoking, talking, fighting.
We saw this a lot driving through Ohio, he explained without me having to prompt him.
After people lost their houses, they'd go to the nearest closed hotel and try to fight over the rooms there. Gangs and all that crap. The motel he settled on was a Howard Johnson Express, one with a quarter of its parking lot filled with different makes and models of cars, and the blue vacancy sign on. I held my breath as he navigated around the outer ring of rooms, careful to avoid driving past the office. He picked a spot at the very edge of the lot, surveying the line of rooms in front of us. Two were easily ruled out. We could see the glow of the TV through the windows and curtains, but the others weren't as obviously occupied.
"Wait here a sec," he said, unbuckling his seatbelt. "I'm going to scope out the area, make sure it's safe."
And it was just like before. He didn't bother to wait for any of us to protest. He just jumped out of the car, glanced into each room he passed, and began to jimmy the door of his choosing. Chubbs and I were left to divide up the last of the food we had gathered from the gas station in Marlington. Our inventory was down to a bag of Cheetos, peanut butter crackers, some Twizzlers, and a snack pack of Oreos, plus the candy I had managed to stuff into my backpack. It was every six-year-old's dream feast. We worked silently, avoiding each other's gaze like champions. Chubbs's fingers were quick and nimble as he opened the peanut butter crackers and started in on them. The same ratty book was on his lap, the pages open and smiling up at him. I knew he couldn't actually be reading them, not with eyesight as bad as his, at least. But when he finally decided to talk to me, he didn't so much as glance up from it.
"Enjoying our life of crime yet? The general seems to think you're a natural."
I reached over to wake Zoo, ignoring whatever it was he was trying to imply. I was too exhausted to deal with him, and, frankly, none of the comebacks warring at the tip of my tongue at the moment were likely to win him over. Before I could step out of the van, my backpack and food in hand, Chubb's hand reached out and slammed the door shut again. In the dim light of the hotel, he looked not angry, exactly, but certainly not friendly either.
"I have something to say to you."
"You've already said quite a bit, thanks." He waited until I had looked back at him over my shoulder before continuing.
"I'm not going to pretend like you didn't help us today, or that you didn't spend years living in a glorified shithole, but I'm telling you now. Use tonight to think seriously about your decision to stay, and if you decide to slip out in the middle of the night, know that you probably made the right choice."
I reached again for the door, but he wasn't finished.
"I know you're hiding something. I know you haven't been completely honest. And if you think for some insane reason that we can protect you, think again. We'll be lucky to make it out of this mess alive without whatever crisis you are bringing to the table." I felt my stomach clench, but kept my face neutral. If he was hoping to read some clue in my face, he was going to be disappointed. I'd spent the better part of the last 6 years schooling my expression into perfect innocence under the threat of guns. Whatever he suspected couldn't have been the truth, though. Otherwise, he wouldn't be giving me one last chance to duck and run. He would have personally punted me out of the van, preferably at a high speed in the middle of a deserted highway. Chubbs rubbed a thumb across his lower lip.
"I think," he started. "I hope you get to Virginia Beach. I really do. But..."
He pulled the glasses off his face and pinched the bridge of his nose.
"This is ridiculous. I'm sorry. Just think about what I said. Make the right choice."
Liam began waving at us from the door of the room, keeping it propped open with his foot. Zoo put a hand on Chubb's shoulder. He jumped, blinking in surprise at the touch of yellow rubber. She had been so silent, I had forgotten she was there, too.
"Come on, Suzume," Chubbs said, dropping a hand on her shoulder. "Maybe, if we're lucky, the general will deign to let us take showers. And maybe, if we're really lucky, he'll actually take one himself."
Zoo followed him out the side door, casting an anxious look my way. I waved her off with a forced smile and reached in the back seat for my black backpack. I didn't notice it until I was already outside, the darkening sky sapping away the last bit of the van's warmth from my skin. One of my hands reached out to hold the sliding door open as I leaned back into the minivan and pulled the book out of the passenger seat's back pouch. It was the first and only time I had seen it free from Chubb's hands. The flat, empty M&M's bag he was using as a bookmark was still in place. I flipped the book open to that page and didn't need to look at the spine to know instantly what book it was. Watership Down by Richard Adams. No wonder he had gone to such great lengths to hide what he was reading. The story of a bunch of rabbits trying to make their way in the world? Liam would have a field day. But I loved that book, and apparently Chubbs did too. It was the same old edition my dad used to read to me before bed, the one I used to steal from his study and put on my shelf for when I couldn't sleep at night. How had it come to me, just when I needed it the most? My eyes drank in each word, worshipping their shape until my lips started forming them, and I was reading aloud for everyone and no one to hear. "All the world will be your enemy, prince with 1,000 enemies, and whenever they catch you, they will kill you. But first, they must catch you, digger, listener, runner, prince with a swift warning. Be cunning and full of tricks, and your people shall never be destroyed." I wondered if Chubbs knew how the story ended. 12. The hot water was enough to make me forget I was standing in an old motel shower, washing my hair with shampoo that reeked of fake lavender. In the entire compact bathroom, there were only 6 things. The sink, the toilet, the towel, the shower, its curtain, and me. I was the last one in. By the time I finally walked through the motel room door, Zoo had already been in and out, and Chubbs had just barricaded himself in the bathroom, where he spent the next hour scrubbing himself and all of his clothing until they stank of stale soap. It seemed pointless to me to try to do laundry in a sink with hand soap, but there was no bathtub or laundry detergent for him to use. The rest of us just sat back and tuned out his impassioned speech on the importance of good hygiene. "You're next," Liam had said, turning to me. "Just make sure you wipe down everything when you're done." I caught the towel he threw to me. "What about you?" "I'll take one in the morning." With the bathroom door shut and locked behind me, I dropped my backpack on the toilet seat cover and went to work sorting through its contents. I pulled out the clothes they had given me and dumped them on the floor. Something silky and red spilled out on top of the pile, causing me to jump back in alarm. It took several moments of suspicious inspection to figure out what it was. The bright red dress from the trailer's closet. "Zoo," I thought, passing a tired hand over my face. She must have grabbed it when I wasn't looking. I poked at it with a toe, nose wrinkling at its faint scent of stale cigarette smoke. It looked like it was going to be a size too large for me, not to mention the somewhat icky feeling that came with knowing where it had been. But, clearly, she had wanted me to have it, and wearing it, loath as I was to admit it, was smarter than running around in my camp uniform. I could do this for Zoo. If it made her happy, it'd be worth the discomfort. There was no shampoo, but the Children's League had thought to give me deodorant, a bright green toothbrush, a pack of tissues, some tampons, and hand sanitizer, all travel-sized and zipped up tight in a plastic bag. Under that was a small hairbrush and water bottle, and there, at the very bottom of the bag, was another panic button. It must have been there the entire time, and I just hadn't realized it. I'd thrown the first one Kate had given me away, leaving it behind in the mud and brush. The thought that this one had been in my bag all this time, the entire time, made my skin crawl. Why hadn't I thoroughly searched the bag before now? I picked it up between two fingers and dropped it into the sink like it had been a piece of hot coal. My hand was on the faucet ready to drown the stupid thing in water and fry it for good, but something stopped me. I'm not sure how long I stared down at it before I picked it up again and held it toward the light, trying to see if I could peer inside of the black outer shell. I looked for a red blinking light that would tell me if it was recording. I held it up to my ear, listening for any kind of whirring or beeping that would tell me if it was activated. If it was on, or if it really was a tracker, wouldn't they have caught up to us by now? Was it so bad to keep it? Just in case something happened again and I couldn't help the others? Wouldn't being with the League be better than being thrown back into Thurmond? Being killed? Wasn't anything better than that? When I put the panic button back in the pocket of the backpack, it wasn't for me. If Kate had seen me, she would have smiled, and the thought only made me angry all over again. I couldn't believe in my own ability to protect these kids. Stepping under the shower's perfect warm spray was already surreal enough without having to hear the click, 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 beep of Thurman's automatic timer to keep my wash time under 3 minutes. It was a good thing, too, since the dirt seemed to come off me in slow layers. A good 15 minutes of scrubbing, and it felt like I had turned every inch of my skin inside out. I even tried using the bubblegum pink razor that had been included in the hotel's small pack of soap and shampoo, opening up old and new scabs on my shins and knees. 16 years old, I thought, and this is the first time I've been able to shave my legs. It was stupid. So stupid. I didn't know what I was doing, and I didn't care. I was old enough. No one was going to stop me. My mom always came back to me in flashes. Sometimes I'd hear her voice, just a word or two. Other times I'd have a memory so real it was like reliving the moment altogether. And now, as I kept at it, all I could think of was that conversation we'd had about this very thing, and her smile as she repeated over and over again, "Maybe when you're 13. Eventually, I washed the razor off and threw it in the direction of my bag. I didn't think anyone else would want to use it now. With blood running down my legs, I turned my attention to the nest on my head. My hair was still too tangled for me to run my hands through it. I had to work through it knot by knot, using more of the shampoo than I had ever meant to, and by the time I was finished, I was crying. I'm 16. I don't know what brought it out. One minute I was fine, and the next it felt like my chest had collapsed in on itself. I tried to take in a deep breath, but the air was too hot. My hands found the wall's white tile first, a second before the rest of my body collapsed against it. I sat down on the rough, fake stone floor of the shower and pressed my hands to my chest, grateful for the noise of the running water and overhead vent, which hid the sound of me breaking into pieces. I didn't want them to hear me like this. Especially not Zoo. It was stupid. So stupid. I was 16. So what? So what I hadn't seen my parents in 6 years? So what I might never see them again? It's not like they remembered me anyway. I should have been happy that it was over, that I was out of that place. But inside or out, I was alone,
and I was beginning to wonder if I always had been, if I always would be. The water pressure wavered, its temperature spiking as someone in the next room over flushed the toilet. It didn't matter, I could barely feel it blasting against my back. My fingers went to my bleeding knees and pressed down, but I couldn't feel that either. Kate had told me that I needed to divide my life into three acts and close the first two behind me. But how did someone do that? How were you just supposed to forget? There was a knock on the door, faint, almost tentative at first, but more insistent when I didn't answer right away. "Ruby?" I heard Liam's voice call. "You okay?" I took a deep breath and reached back, hand feeling through the air for the faucet. The water overhead faded to a mere drizzle, and then a drip, and then nothing at all. "Can you, open the door? Just for a sec?" He sounded nervous enough to make me nervous. For one terrifying split second, I thought something had happened. I reached for the towel and wrapped it around myself. My fingers flicked the lock over and were turning the doorknob before my brain caught up. A blast of icy air was the first thing to hit me. Liam's wide eyes were the second. The pair of big white socks in his hand, the third. He glanced around the bathroom over my shoulder, his mouth pressed in a grim line. The motel room was darker than it had been when I first walked in. We must have been well into night now. So I couldn't be sure, not in any real way, but I thought I caught a hint of color flooding the tips of his ears. "Is everything all right?" I whispered. He stared at me, letting the warm fog from the bathroom wash over him. "Liam!" The socks were thrust in my direction. I looked down at them and then up at him, hoping I didn't look as flabbergasted as I felt. "Just wanted to give you these," he said, giving them a little shake. He thrust them again in my direction. "You know, for you." "Don't you need them?" I asked. "I have a couple extra pairs and you have none, right?" He looked like he was in some kind of pain now. "Seriously, please, just take them. Chubb says your extremities or whatever are the first things to get cold, so you need them, and..." "Oh my God, Green," I heard Chubb say from somewhere in the room. "Just take the damn socks and put the kid out of his misery." Liam didn't wait for me to hold out a hand. He reached past me and deposited them on the counter right next to the sink. Thanks, I said. "Great. I mean, no problem." Liam turned to walk away, only to turn back again, as if thinking of something else. "Okay. Great. Cool. Well, so you..."
"Use your words, Lee," Chubbs called. "Some of us are trying to get some sleep."
"Oh, right. Sleep." Liam made a vague motion toward the room's bed. "You and Zoo are going to share. I hope you don't mind." "Of course not," I said. "Okay. Great." He put an abnormally bright smile on his face. I wondered what he was waiting for me to do or say. If this was one of those moments that being trapped in a cabin with dozens of girls for 6 years had failed to prepare me for. It was like we were speaking in two different languages.
"Yeah. Great," I repeated, more confused now than ever.
That seemed to do the trick, though. Liam turned and walked away without another word. I picked up my new socks from the counter, examining them. Just before I shut the door, I heard Chubb's voice, tinged with his usual told-you-so.
"Hope you're pleased with yourself," he was saying. "You should have just left her alone. She was fine."
But I hadn't been, and somehow Liam had known. Took me several long moments to realize it was Zoo's dream. She and I were on the room's queen-size bed, huddled together for warmth. The boys were on the floor with the blankets, using extra towels stolen from a cleaning cart as pillows. The collective brain trust of Chubbs and Liam hadn't been able to figure out how to turn down the air conditioning unit, which insisted on spitting out its frosty breath every time the room so much as dared to spike to 60 degrees. I had been hovering around the sweet, milky edges of sleep for hours when I felt the itch at the back of my mind.
There was a part of me that had been expecting it. Even though my body had settled onto the bed like a slab of concrete, my brain was still buzzing around in circles, processing what had happened with the PSFs, wondering if I could do what I had done to that man again, when Zoo's bare feet brushed against mine, and that was all it took. I was pulled into her dream head first. I was Zoo, and Zoo was in a small bed, staring up at the underbelly of a brown mattress. Darkness blurred around us until finally some recognizable shapes emerged. Stacks of bunk beds, a chalkboard, bright blue cabinets that stretched from floor to ceiling, large windows boarded up with plywood, and strange square discolorations on the wall, where posters must have once hung. I couldn't tear away. That was the dangerous thing about the dreams, how quickly you became tangled in it all. People naturally let their guard down when they slept, so much so that sometimes, if the dream was frightening enough, I didn't even need a touch to be drawn into it. I couldn't smell the smoke, but I saw it right away, gliding beneath the old classroom's door like spilled milk racing across the ground. A moment later, I jolted up, rolling until I was off the bed completely. I watched in slow, dawning horror as a dozen girls jumped down from their bunks and gathered in a buzzing huddle at the center of the room. One girl, who must have been a good head taller and 4 years older than the others, tried to get them to crouch in a line beneath the windows, with no success. Her arms were waving through the air, the long sleeves of her simple mustard yellow uniform blurring. And then, the alarms went off and the door at the far end of the room swung open. The sound the bell made was nearly as excruciating as the white noise, its pitch stretched and distorted by the dream. I was jostled forward as the other little girls made a break for the door. It didn't seem to matter to them that the smoke was suffocating, or that it didn't have a visible source. In the place of neat, orderly lines was mass chaos. Kids with green, navy, and yellow uniforms spilled out into the white-tiled hallway. The emergency lights were on, fire alarms flashing red and yellow along the wall. I was thrown into the crushing river of bodies, all headed in the same direction, the direction of the smoke. My vision blurred with tears and forced the breath out of my chest. One glance over my shoulder was enough to see some of the older kids, both boys and girls, dragging out the blue cabinets from their room and knocking them over in front of the silver double doors at the other end of the hallway. We weren't evacuating at all. We were escaping. My vision was swimming in black by the time we were pushed through the other set of doors and into the cramped stairway. The smoke was thickest there, rising not from shimmering flames, but two small black canisters, the kind PSFs kept hooked on their belts, waiting to be thrown into a crowd of unruly kids. So the PSFs set them off? No, that wasn't possible. It was much more likely a few kids had nabbed them to get the alarms going and the doors open. That was probably the extent of their emergency protocol. We were trapped in that stairwell, our bodies pressed against everyone else's in one shivering mass of nerves and exhilaration. I tried to keep my eyes forward and feel for the steps under my feet, but it was hard not to see what the darkness and flashing lights were doing to the other kids. Some were crying hysterically, some looked on the verge of passing out, but some were laughing. Laughing like it was a game. I don't know how I spotted the other small Asian girl under the tide of hands and heads. She was wedged in the bottom left corner of the stairwell landing, standing on her toes, her green uniform barely visible. Her hair was gleaming black under the emergency lights, and her arm was above her head, outstretched. Toward me? The minute I made eye contact with her, her face lit up in recognition. I saw her mouth form Zoo's name. I tried to reach out, to grab her hand, but the swarm of people around me pushed me down, jostling forward. By the time I turned around, she had disappeared too. I didn't see one PSF or camp controller. Not until we were at the base of the stairwell, stepping over, but mostly on, the three prone black figures on the ground. Their faces were swollen into bruised masks, blood collected on the ground under them. Someone, probably a Blue, had ripped the doors from their hinges and sent them flying outside into what looked like a wasteland of white snow. The ground was unnaturally bright under the moonless sky, partly from the dream, partly from the searchlights that switched on as the pitch of the alarm changed from a trill to a warning siren. Once we were out those final doors, we were running. The snow was knee-deep, and most of the kids weren't wearing anything beyond their paper-thin uniforms. Most of them hadn't even remembered to put on their shoes. Tiny flakes floated into the deep intersecting lines of footprints, and for a moment I felt myself slow, watching the way the snow was neither flying nor falling, just hovering there like a held breath, lighting up like a thousand fireflies under the camp searchlights. And then the spell was broken, shattered with the first gunshot. And then it was bullets flying over us, not snow. The screams ripped, jagged and piercing, from the throats of hundreds of kids. 5, 10, 15, it was impossible to count the kids that suddenly pitched forward, falling face first into the snow, screaming and howling in pain. A nightmarish red began to creep through the snow like spilled ink spreading, expanding, devouring. I reached up to my cheek, to the wetness there, and when I pulled my hand away, my brain finally connected that I had run straight through a spray of blood. I was covered in it. Someone else's blood was dripping down my cheeks and off my chin. We ran harder, faster, toward the back right corner of the chain-link fence surrounding the old school. I threw a look back over my shoulder to the brick school building, to the dozens of black figures on top of its gray slate roof, to the dozens more pouring out from the first-story windows and doors. When I turned back, the field in front of me was covered in heaps of every color, yellow, blue, green, and red. So, so much red. They formed lines, unwilling barriers that others had to jump over to keep going. I fell forward, barely catching myself on the snow. Something, someone had caught my ankle. A green girl on her stomach crawling toward me, her eyes open, her mouth gulping at the air. "Help me!" she was sobbing, blood bubbling up over her lips. "Help me!" But I got back up and ran. There was a gate at this edge of the camp. I could see it now that I was within a few hundred feet of it. What I couldn't see was what was causing the backup of kids, why we weren't dashing through the gate to get to freedom. With a jolt, I realized there were almost three times as many kids down in the snow behind me than there were in front of me. The cluster of kids surged forward with a unified wail, hundreds of hands straining forward. My size made it easy for me to slip through legs and fight my way up to the front, where three older boys in blue uniforms were struggling to keep the crowd of kids back from both the gate itself and the one-man watch booth beside it, which was currently playing host to three people, an unconscious PSF, Liam, and Chubbs. I was so shocked at the sight of them, I nearly missed the blur of green that was a little kid rushing for the fence. He darted around the teenagers in his path and threw himself against the bright yellow bars holding the gate firmly in place. He had only just touched it when all of the hair on his head seemed to stand on end and a burst of light flashed under his fingers. Instead of releasing it, his hand only seemed to clamp down harder, frozen in place as thousands of volts of electricity sent his body into a frenzied fit of shuddering. Oh my God. The gate was still on. Liam and Chubbs were trying to turn it off. I felt my own scream bubble up in my throat when he collapsed to the ground, finally still. Liam yelled something from the booth that I couldn't hear, not above the screams from the kids around me. The sight of that boy burst the temporary bubble of calm in a heartbeat. The PSFs were closer now. They had to be, because when they started firing again, it was like shooting fish in a barrel. Each layer of kids fell down and away, peeling back to reveal a new, fresh layer for the kill. I couldn't see the snow beneath them anymore. Kids turned and bolted in every direction, some heading back toward the school, others following the edges of the electrified fence, looking for another way out. I heard dogs bark and the growling of engines. Combined, the noises sounded like a monster straight out of hell. I turned to look at the trail the animals and snowmobiles were blazing toward us when something hard slammed into me from behind,
throwing me into the thick snow. "I'm shot," I thought, half in shock. No, that wasn't right. The blow had come from an elbow to the back of the head. The blue girl hadn't even seen me as she turned and ran back toward the camp. I rolled over just in time to see her with her hands in the air, a clear surrender. And still, still, they shot her. She shrieked in pain and crumbled to the ground. It wasn't just the girl who hadn't spotted me in the snow. No one did. I felt my arm stinging with the cold strain as I tried to push myself up and out of its freezing touch. But every time I made progress, another foot came slamming down across my shoulders and back. I had enough time to cover my head, but that was it. There was no getting air to my chest. I was screaming, and no one could hear. Rage and despair ripped through me. The crush of stampeding kids pushed me deeper and deeper into the snow, and I kept thinking, can you drown like this? Can you suffocate in the freezing dark? Would it be better to die this way? Hands reached around my waist. Freezing air flooded my lungs in a single painful gasp as I was lifted up and out of the snow. The gate was open now, and the kids who had been steady and calm enough to remain, who had been lucky enough not to be hit, poured through, running for the dense cluster of trees ahead. There couldn't have been more than 20. Of the hundreds of kids who had flooded through the halls of the old school, 20. I felt warm, impossibly warm. The arms holding me tightened. When I looked up, it was into Liam's bright eyes. Hang on tight, okay? Zu woke with a gasp, coming up from her nightmare for a long drag of air. I was thrown out of the dream, sent hurtling back into the freezing hotel room. Through the topsy-turvy vertigo that slammed into me, I turned toward Zu, my eyes adjusting just enough to make out her silhouette. When I reached for her, I found someone else's hands already there. Liam shook his head, trying to snap himself out of sleep's lingering grasp. "Zu," he whispered. "Hey, Zu." I stayed perfectly still. "Hey," Liam said gently. "You're okay. It was just a bad dream." My gut twisted when I realized she was crying. I heard a scraping sound, wood against wood, like he had taken something out of the nightstand. "Write it down," Liam said. "Don't force yourself." It must have been the hotel stationery. I shut my eyes, waiting for him to switch on the cheap nightstand lamp, but he kept to his rule. No lights outside the bathroom. "What are you sorry for?" he whispered. "The only one that needs beauty sleep is Chubbs." She let out a shaky laugh, but her body was still tense next to mine. "Was it the same one as before?" The bed dipped as Liam sat down. "A little different?" he repeated after a moment. "Yeah?" The silence stretched a little longer this time. I wasn't sure she was still scribbling in the darkness until Liam cleared his throat and said in a rough voice, "I could never forget that. I was really worried you had tried to touch the gate before Chubbs figured out how to switch it off." And then, so soft that I might have imagined it, he said, "I'm so sorry." The guilt and misery that coated the words were like a kick to the chest. I felt myself shift forward on the bed, drawn to the pain there, desperate to reassure him that what had happened there in the snowy field hadn't been his fault. It scared me, knowing how well I understood him in that moment. But I couldn't. This was a private conversation, just like her memory had been private. Why was I always trespassing into places I didn't belong? "Chubbs isn't the only one that thinks it's too dangerous. But I think Ruby's tough enough to make it without us if she wants to." "Why?" More scribbling. "The only thing Chubbs wants is for us to be safe," he said, still whispering. "Sometimes that gets in the way of him doing what's good for others. Seeing the big picture, you know? It's only been 2 weeks since we got out. You got to give him more time." He sounded so confident then that I felt a small part of me give. I believed him.
Oh, man.
I could practically see him running a hand through his hair. Never be ashamed of what you can do. You hear me? If you hadn't been there, we wouldn't be here. The room settled back into a peaceful quiet, save for Chubb's wheezing snores.
You feeling better?
He asked.
Need anything from Betty?
She must have shaken her head because I felt the bed shift again as Liam stood.
I'll be right here. Just wake me up if you change your mind, okay?
I didn't hear him say goodnight, but instead of lying down, I saw him sit, back flush against the bed, watching the door and anything that might come through it. A few hours later, with the moon still visible in the gray-blue morning sky, I gently untangled Zoo's fingers from the front of my dress and slipped out of the bed. The red glow of the alarm clock on the nightstand burned the time into my mind. 5:03 a.m. Leaving time. None of us had really unpacked our things, on Liam's insistence, but I had to collect my toothbrush and toothpaste from where I had left them next to Chubb's in the bathroom. There was one set of Hojo toiletries left out by the sink, next to the world's ugliest coffee maker. I stuffed them into my bag, along with one of the smaller hand towels. Outside, it was only a few degrees warmer than it had been in the room. Typical bipolar Virginia spring weather. It must have rained the night before, too. A feathery white fog threaded through the cars and nearby trees. The minivan, which last night had been parked on the far end of the lot, was now stationed directly in front of the hotel room. If I hadn't walked right by Black Betty, running my hand against her bruised side, I don't think I would have seen Liam at all. He was kneeling beside the sliding door, slowly scraping off the last of the Betty Jean cleaning sign with his car keys. At his feet was the Ohio plate that had, at one point, been screwed into place. My feet drifted to a stop a few feet short of him. There were dark circles under his eyes. His face was drawn in thought, his mouth set in a grim line that didn't suit him at all. With his damp hair combed back and his face clean-shaven, he could have looked a good 2 or 3 years younger than he had the day before, but his eyes told a different story. My shoes scuffed the loose asphalt, catching Liam's attention. He started to rise.
"What's wrong?"
"Huh?"
"You're up early," he explained. "I usually have to drag Chubbs into the shower and blast him with cold water to get him going."
I shrugged. "Still on Thurman's schedule, I guess." He rose to his feet slowly, wiping his hands on the front of his jeans. The way his eyes flicked toward me made me think he wanted to say something, but instead, he only gave me a small smile. The Ohio license plate was tossed into the back seat, and in its place was a West Virginia plate. I didn't have a chance to ask where it had come from. I dropped my backpack at my feet and leaned against the minivan's door. Liam disappeared around the back of the car, reappearing a few minutes later with a red gas can and a chewed-up black hose in hand. With my eyes closed and ear pressed against the cool glass, I soaked up the honeyed sing-song radio commercial for a local grocery store. When the broadcaster came back on, it was with a grim forecast of whatever was left of Wall Street. The woman read the stock report like a eulogy. I forced my eyes open, letting them fall where Liam had been standing only a second before. "Liam?" I called before I could stop myself.
"Over here,"
came the immediate reply. With a quick glance to the row of aquamarine motel doors, I shuffled around the back of the van until I was a few feet behind him. I stood on my toes, leaning to the right to get a better look at what he was doing to the silver SUV parked next to the van. Liam worked silently, his light eyes focused on the task at hand. One end of the hose was shoved deep into the belly of the SUV's gas tank. He looped the excess length of the unruly hose around his shoulder and let the other end fall in the red can.
"What are you doing?"
I didn't bother to hide my shock. His free hand hovered over the length of the hose, gliding it back in our direction. It was almost like he was tugging in a line, or at least motioning someone forward. A few drops of pungent liquid began to drip from the free end of the hose. Siphoning gas, I realized. I'd heard about people doing this during the last gas shortage, but I'd never actually seen it done before. The liquid began to fill the can in a smooth pour, filling the space between us with a sharp odor.
Gas crisis, he said with an unapologetic shrug. Times are a little desperate, and we were running on fumes for a while yesterday.
You're blue, right? I said, nodding toward the hand guiding the gas into our red can. Could you just move Betty along without it?
Yeah, but not for long.
Liam sounded shy. When he pressed his lips together, they turned an unnatural shade of white and highlighted a small scar at the right corner. When I realized I was staring, I squatted down beside him, more to hide my embarrassment than actually help. Stealing gas was, surprisingly, not all that complicated.
I guess I'm just impressed that you can use your abilities at all.
A part of me wondered then if I hadn't had it backward this entire time. The way things were at Thurmond, the camp controllers were so vigilant about making sure that we were terrified of getting caught using our abilities, and we were made to understand from the beginning that what we were and what we could do was dangerous and unnatural. Mistakes and accidents were not excuses, and punishment was not avoidable. There was to be no curious testing, no stabbing at limits to see if there was a way to push through them. If Liam was so accomplished with his abilities, it probably meant he had taken years to practice, most of those spent outside of camp walls. It never occurred to me to think that other kids, safe at home, hiding out, that the others, who had never seen the inside of a cabin, experienced the grave and still nothing that was life at camp, might have managed to teach themselves amazing things. They weren't afraid of themselves. They weren't crippled by the weight of what they didn't know. I had the strangest feeling, like I had lost something without ever really having it in the first place, that I wasn't what I once was, and wasn't at all what I was meant to be. The sensation made me feel hollow down to my bones.
The whole thing's pretty straightforward for us blues, Liam explained. You look at something, concentrate hard enough to imagine that object moving from point A to point B, and it just does, he said. I bet a lot of the blues at Thurmond figured out how to use their abilities. They just chose not to. Maybe something to do with that noise.
You're probably right. I hadn't had enough interaction with the blue kids to know. Liam jerked the hose back and forth as a stream of gas slowed to a measly drip. I glanced up, searching the parking lot and motel doors for signs of life, and didn't settle back down until I was sure we were alone.
Did you teach yourself? I asked, testing my theory.
He glanced my way.
Yeah, I went into camp pretty late and had plenty of time alone, bored out of my mind, to figure things out.
Naturally, the next question was, were you in hiding? But I wouldn't be able to ask that without him asking about my history and how I was caught. This had to stop. My hands were shaking like he had just told me he was about to strangle the life out of me. Nothing he had done up until now had proven him to be anything other than nice. Hadn't he shown me, time and time again, that he was willing to be my friend, if I was willing to let him? It had been so long since I'd even wanted a friend that I wasn't sure I even remembered how to go about making one. In first grade, it had been stupidly simple. Our teacher had told us to write down our favorite animal on a sheet of paper, and then we had to go around the room until we found someone with a matching animal. Because making friends was supposed to be that easy, apparently. Finding someone else who liked elephants.
I like this song, I blurted out.
Jim Morrison's voice was soft and barely reached us from where it was filtering through Betty's speakers.
Yeah? The Doors?
Liam's face lit up.
Come on, baby, light my fire, he crooned in a low voice, trying to match Morrison's. Try to set the night on fire.
I laughed.
I like it when he sings it.
Liam clutched his chest like I had wounded him, but his recovery was quick. The radio DJ announced the next song. It was like Liam had won the lottery.
Now this is what I'm talking about.
The Allman Brothers? My eyebrows were inching up my face. Funny, I had pegged him for a Zeppelin fan.
This is the music of my soul, he said, nodding his head in time with the music.
Have you ever actually listened to the lyrics? I asked, feeling the anxiety lift off my shoulders. My voice was growing steadier with each word. Was your father a gambler down in Georgia that wound up on the wrong end of a gun? Were you born in the back seat of a Greyhound bus? Hey now, he said, reaching over to flick my hair. I said it was the music of my soul, not my life. For information, my stepdad is a mechanic down in North Carolina and, as far as I know, still alive and well. But I was born in the backseat of a bus.
You're joking.
I honestly couldn't tell. Am not. It made the newspapers and everything. I was the miracle bus boy for the first 3 years of my life. And now I'm trying to make a living and doing the best I can, I finished. He laughed, the tips of his ears tinged with a faint pink. The song went on, filling the air between us with its rapid pulse and relentless guitars. Every piece fit together effortlessly. Not quite country and not quite rock and roll. Just warm, fast, southern. I liked it even better when Liam started singing along. When the flow of gas had stopped, he carefully pulled the hose free and replaced the gas cap. Before he stood, Liam knocked his shoulder into mine. Where in the world did you get that dress? I snorted, picking at the skirt. Present from Zoo. You look like you want to throw it into a fire. I can't promise there won't be an unfortunate accident later on, I said very seriously. When he laughed again, it felt like a small victory. Well, Green, it was nice of you to put it on, Liam said. Though, be careful. Zoo's so starved for girl time that she might turn you into her own personal dress-up doll. Kids these days, I said. Think the whole world belongs to them. He grinned. Kids these days. We moved from car to car, working our way down the parking lot. He didn't ask for my help, and I didn't ask him any more questions. We could have stayed together in that comfortable silence for hours, and it still wouldn't have been enough for me. 13. Chubbs and Zoo were not happy to be woken up at 5:30 a.m., and even less enthusiastic about Liam forcing them to make the bed while we freshened up the bathroom and replaced the used towels. Not exactly clean of us, but it was better than alerting the management they had hosted a bunch of squatters for the night. Chubbs took one look at me as he marched out to the minivan and stopped dead in his tracks. He wore his thought plain as day on his face. You're still here. I shrugged. Deal with it. He shook his head and let out another one of his sighs. Once we were settled, Zoo and Chubbs in the middle seats, we all watched as Liam closed the hotel room door, cup of crappy hotel coffee in hand. That's right, I thought, glancing at Zoo out of the corner of my eye. She had curled up on her seat and was using her gloved hands as a pillow. Didn't get much sleep, did he? Liam ran through his usual routine of checking the mirror's position, adjusting the recline of his seat, buckling himself in, and turning the keys in the ignition. But Liam's next order of business upon returning to the minivan wasn't to answer any of the number of questions Chubbs threw his way about where we were going. He waited until his friend was good and snoring before calling back to me. Can you read a map? The embarrassment and shame that washed through me painted my face red. No, sorry. Wasn't that something your dad was supposed to teach you eventually? No problem. Liam patted the empty passenger seat. I'll teach you later, but for now I just need someone to watch the signs for me. Come on up to the co-pilot chair. I jerked a thumb in the direction of Chubbs. Liam only shook his head. Are you kidding me? Yesterday he thought a mailbox was a clown. I unbuckled my seatbelt with a sigh. As I climbed over Chubb's outstretched legs to the front, I glanced over my shoulder, my eyes going to his two small glasses. Is his eyesight really that bad? Worse, Liam said. So, right after we got the hell out of Caledonia, we broke into this house to spend the night, right? I woke up in the middle of the night hearing the most awful noise, like a cow dying or something. I followed the wailing, clutching some kid's baseball bat, thinking I was going to have to beat someone's head in for us to make a clean getaway. Then I saw what was sitting at the bottom of the drained pool. No way, I said. Way, he confirmed, Hawkeye had gone out to relieve himself and had somehow missed the giant gaping hole in the ground, twisted his ankle, and couldn't climb out of the deep end. I tried so hard not to laugh, but it was impossible. The mental image was just too damn good. Liam reached over and switched on the radio, letting me choose the station.